I want you to think back to the last time you learned something new. Maybe it was in a classroom, maybe you had taken up a new hobby or tried to learn a new language. Maybe there's a computer program you just picked up for the very first time. And if you think about that moment of acquiring a new skill, you think about who you were before you started learning this thing and who you were afterwards. Would you say that you're a different person? Would you say that you have somehow fundamentally changed overall? Now, most people would say, no, I'm basically the same person. But maybe I have this new skill that I'm developing, and I'm even having a great time learning it. And that is, I mean, that's awesome. That's like the beauty of being human. One thing that pretty much all of us experience when we try to start to learn something new is that at first, whatever that new skill or technique that we've adopted into our life, once it started to take hold, we see this immediate rise in efficiency and overall well-being and change in the skill in general. Like, you know, just for an example, let's say it was swing dancing and you're a terrible swing dancer. You're a person who steps on everyone's feet. Well, you take a couple classes and you are going to become a much better swing dancer. Because you're starting from a baseline of, well, nothing, right? This is what happens when you go from 0 to 1. You get a lot better. But over time, you realize that you're going to start to plateau, right? Like you start swing dancing and all of a sudden now you feel comfortable on the dance floor and that is awesome, but you're not going to be winning any dance competitions, not immediately. There are people who have dedicated their lives to swing dancing, and you're not going to compete. Well, this curve of learning a new skill or adopting really any practice and that eventual tapering off is what we call the law of diminishing returns. And it afflicts real just about everything that a human does. When you first start learning something, you are on this rise, this asymptotic curve where you're going from absolutely nothing to, hey, my life is changing, it's getting better, until it eventually plateaus. This podcast today is about the law of diminishing returns and perhaps a different way to think about what that process actually is and how we can hijack it to change our lives for the better overall. Because the law of diminishing returns, looked at from one perspective, is, well, a little depressing, right? You get better and then you taper off and, you know, it's going to be a lot of work to see the same sort of rise in the future. However, I think another way to think about it is that the law of diminishing returns is also, at the same time, the law of speedy gains. And it's just this little switch in the way we think about things. The law of speedy gains is, hey, you try something new and you're going to get a lot better at that thing and your life will change until it doesn't, until it sort of tapers off. But you always have access to those gains in other fields. Hey, I'm a terrible dancer. If I went off with my wife, though, and we took swing dancing lessons, I'd get better. If I pick up a new sport, I'm going to start off really bad, but I'll get to some measure of competence, or at least betteritude, that's totally a word, a little bit of betteritude in a few days or weeks. And while none of us, or at least very few of us, are going to be champions at really anything in life, I don't compete against Olympic medalists. What I can be is an exceptional dilettante at, well, many, many things at once. The law of speedy gains is amazing. So let's talk about these two distinctions and how this changes human psychology. Now, if you've been following me at all, you know I have a thing about cults. I write about them. I read about them. I am fascinated with the ability for organizations to be very beneficial at the beginning and enrapture you with a description of the universe that defies your ordinary perceptions of reality, but becomes the defining thing in your life. The thing that most people don't get about cults is that they generally offer an enormous benefit to the person who joins them for a number of reasons. One, there's a community of like-minded people who are really interested in you personally, and you might not be the sort of person who gets a lot of normal interest in your work, in your life, in your feelings, and this is super important, and they offer techniques that speak to something primal in you. There are practices that will change your life for the better, and you will see everything in your life improve, at least on the short term. Cults love the law of speedy gains. Let's say, for example, we're talking about a meditation cult, but this could also be a prayer cult. It could be a heat cult. It could be a financial scheme. It could be a lots of different things. But let's just say this is a meditation cult. We all know that, and every study on meditation shows that once you take up that practice of a meditation technique, your life starts to get better. You have more clear thought, less anxiety, maybe your immune system gets better. You feel like you have more attention to the world around you, and you experience a speedy gain due to meditation. And it really doesn't even matter all that much what sort of meditation technique you initially learn. This could be transcendental meditation, it could be Tibetan, some sort of Tibetan tantric practice, or even just basic mindfulness. It could be really any sort of meditation, prayer, or whatever. You start it and you start to get better quickly, and you feel better quickly. And then that feeling of rapid gains, well, it becomes a little bit addictive. You start to say, oh my God, I'm going to dedicate myself to these practices, and you double down. You spend a week with this group, and you realize that there is something good here. And soon, at some point, I mean, I guess it depends on the technique, but at some point, there is this diminishing return. You get to a point where that one special, awesome thing that you tried, it gets a lot harder to have those same increases. And then the cult leader, the teacher, tells you, well, if you sign up for my extra course, if you go for my more advanced teachings, if you do this other thing, that you will experience that same rise all over again, because I have some secret trick in my back pocket. And, you know, sometimes they do have a few other tricks, but they usually lead with their most impressive thing. The upsell into the next level of whatever group you're working with is where that cult transitions the law of speedy gains into the law of diminishing returns, because they've sold you not only on the technique that improves you, but also something of their worldview, something of the way they see the world, and you get attached to that idea. Now, in my book, The Enlightenment Trap, I talk about one particular Buddhist group that sold introductory meditations that are in the Tibetan tradition, and how they said, hey, you want more of this? Let's go to Tantra. Let's go to the secret teachings, which get really, really esoteric very quickly. There are sexual rites associated with it. There are embracing anger, embracing heightened states of perception. And some of these can have beneficial aspects to them. I'm not going to say that Tantra is totally useless, but they are much more involved. It's much harder to have those same gains as you go. And even those gains do taper off over time. Yet the more you invest of yourself, the more time you invest of yourself into something, the more that thing comes to define who you are. You suddenly become a group member, and you also enjoy bringing other people into the groups because you like watching them go through that thing that you just went through, to go through those speedy gains at the beginning of their initiations. And the problem with these gurus is usually, of course, that they don't actually have special secret powers that connect them to the ultimate nature of the universe. Instead, what they have and what they generally sell behind their secret walls are techniques that push on social boundaries in some way or another. Things that ask you to be a little bit more eccentric. You know, in Tantra, you have these sexual rituals. You know, in general, there are these ritualistic sides of things that, sort of delve into some conscious side of your body, but also further make you dependent on the group and the teacher that is teaching you. They've hooked you on those speedy gains. Ultimately, these leaders trade eccentricity and boundary pushing for those speedy gains that initially hooked someone. I mean, Scientology, I don't know if you know much about Scientology, has this thing where they have you grab an E-meter, which are two tubes connected to some sort of electrical conduit, and it looks sort of like a lie detector device of some sort, and you do it, and, you know, just like any good magic trick or tarot reading, it makes you think there's something really interesting going on. That immediately turns into upsells for new courses and new things that you're going to learn. I mean, the Wim Hof method is really not all that different. You know, I've been doing this for a decade. And those first ice baths and those first breathworks you get into are magical and transformative. And I have been doing this for 10 years. I will tell you, there is diminishing returns, even regression over time. I don't hold my breath as long as I used to at all. You know, I think my breath holds are much lower, but I still get some benefits. But it is definitely more work to get there. There are diminishing returns. And if you look at what Wim Hof is teaching lately on his in-person retreats, I mean, it's getting a little culty, right? It's getting into these situations where everyone puts their hands on Wim and they chant mantras with him. They do weird rituals in ice water, and all that is just, you know, all fun and games. But he's definitely trading eccentricity for new and deeper techniques. This isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it is a thing to keep in mind as someone tries to deepen their practice. What are you actually getting with the increase in energy that you're putting into things? But what about the law of speedy gains in general? What if your lifestyle embraced the idea that diminishing returns are what happens when you commit to things, and there are some things that you do want to deepen your practice with? I mean, obviously, I decided to do that with ice water and breathing, and I also write books, but there's a ton of things that I have a shallow level of knowledge and expertise, and that's not a bad thing, you know? I, for instance, love long bike rides. I go on long bike rides relatively frequently, and it's a lot of fun, but I have no ambition to pursue this at a professional level. I wouldn't do very well in that. But picking it up has radically changed my life. And I am okay with not becoming the best bike rider in the world. There's just simply no competition that I want to involve myself with. And sometimes, if you've read my book, The Wedge, you know, I tried about 10 different techniques that challenged my nervous system. And this made me rethink how my body and my mind operate together in the world. And I didn't become an expert at, say, throwing kettlebells. I'm not really an expert at sauna. I don't even know what that would necessarily mean. And while I've done psychedelics, they're certainly not a part of my regular life. Instead, merely trying these new things and giving them just enough weight, just enough interest, just enough attention to experience the law of speedy gains, that I became a better, more full person. And this is something that any of us and all of us have access to all the time. And it doesn't matter whether this is a workout, a meditation practice, a spiritual practice, a diet, a new skill, a new job, a new business idea. Trying new things, you have the benefit and the opportunity of the law of speedy gains. You just have to accept that being a dilettante is not the worst thing in the world. If you embrace this lifestyle, you're not going to be the world expert at anything that you're just trying to, well, try. You maybe have the attention and the focus to get deep on 2, 3, maybe 4 things, but 4 things you're going to top out. You're not going to go deep, but you can go wide. You can go wide, and you can get better at a variety of things, and you can be something of a Renaissance man or a Renaissance woman. Let me give you one example in the workout space in my own life in the last year. So starting back in June, I went on this rafting trip in Idaho where I spent like 5 days on a raft on this beautiful river called the Middle Fork of the Salmon and had a really good time giving some lectures to people, but also just having a blast in nature. And one of the things that I noticed was maybe a little embarrassing. And it came when I saw the photos of the trip that some professional photographer had been shooting. And I saw a picture of myself and I'm like, oh man, Scott, you have gained a lot of weight. I mean, it wasn't the most flattering angle, but it was clear that it was not the healthiest look that I had ever aspired to. And out of coincidence or maybe opportunity, there was this other dude there, pretty buff, like good-looking guy. And I noticed that he was doing a lot of push-ups. Every day he would just do like 100 push-ups, and he said that it was just an easy thing to add to his routine. A few days later, after I had finished with that rafting trip, I came home, and this other friend of mine, a guy named Ryan, he also did these 100 push-ups a day, and it just was a thing that he threw into his day to change his life, change his body just a little bit. And he looked pretty good, and so did this other guy. And I said, hey, starting in July, I am going to do 100 push-ups a day, pretty much from now on, just a small little thing. And 100 push-ups, I mean, it's really not that hard to do 100 push-ups. Like, time-wise, we're talking 4 or 5 minutes. But there is some effort that you need to do. And I changed my technique from doing push-ups like a gecko into sort of more of these, arms at the side, these chaturanga-style push-ups. And I committed to it. And now I'm about 10 months into my, 100 push-ups a day routine. And I've missed 3 days. 2 days because I had COVID and 1 day because I had traveler's diarrhea. Let's not get into that. But I've missed only 3 days and I made those push-ups up later. And while I am by no means He-Man, this one little tiny change has led to dramatic changes in my physiology. I can do these push-ups more, and I'm not trying to do hundreds and thousands of push-ups, just that little diminishing return. I hit my peak and I've lost about 15 pounds. I have a lot more muscles in the top, and it's sort of crazy. And it's a small thing at the same time. And I like that combination. It's one thing that I can add to my life. I get to the diminishing return and then I just maintain it and life is better. And it would be the same thing with learning swing dancing. It would be the same thing with learning a little bit of a foreign language. You learn just enough that if you go to this foreign country and try to talk to people, you will get a little bit better all the time. But you're not going for a PhD in that subject. I'm not trying to look like my buddy, Eric Hinman, who is like a living six-pack. And I mean, it's awesome what he does. I respect what he does, but it's not my goal. The goal is to practice widely and try a lot of new things and not let one technique define me or define you. This is something that we can all benefit from. And maybe you've seen where this is going. If you've been listening to this show, you may have seen the last episode that I put out, which is All Medicine is Mindful Medicine. And there's this thing called the adherence effect and the placebo effect, where the power of someone's intention to heal themselves actually results in healing. And the other thing that I said in that episode is that the act of also realizing that some new therapy that you're using, whether it's in the wellness industry and you're taping your mouth shut or you're getting into ice baths or even real medical treatments with a doctor, the law of diminishing returns often affects those things as well. And sometimes the act of switching between health modalities actually results in better healing outcomes than sticking with one thing alone. And the way you determine when it's time to switch is when those returns start to decrease. Now, I'm not telling you to go ditch your medical routines that you're on right now. You definitely should consult a doctor and be rational about it. But as a general rule, when you notice things are not working for you, you will say, hey, I want to find something that works, and you will change, and then you will get the benefits of something new, which is why all medicine is, to some degree, mindful medicine. It's also why when you're sick, you are not dogmatic on any one therapy. If a doctor gave you a drug for your irritable bowel syndrome or your pain or something like that. And it didn't make you feel better in, say, a week or two of actually trying the protocols, you would be like, hey, doc, I want a different drug. You're not going to be dogmatic to that drug and that one piece of advice. You're going to be paying attention to yourself and you're going to change because maybe the drug just was bad. Maybe it worked a little bit. Maybe it was just the placebo effect that made it work. But you are going to mindfully switch between things. You're going to be looking for the law of speedy gains in different things. I mean, we'll also notice that some things work really well. I've noticed with my Wim Hof breathing practices, I had a really, really good run of a long time with no canker sores, my one sort of lame autoimmune illness that I'd gotten for probably 30 years before I started doing the Wim Hof method. And the Wim Hof method totally stopped my canker sores until about 8 or 9 years in when I got my, you know, 2 or 3 of them and I had to switch up my treatments. That plateau was awesome, but I also need to keep on doing attention and not just be dogmatically focused on one thing that did work for a little while and now has maybe tapered off a little bit over time. So I want you to think about yourself and about the practices that you're doing in your life right now. What has worked for you? What continues to work for you? And what might not be worth the investment? Now, I can't answer this for you in particular, but I can say, hey, why not try some new things? Why not be a dilettante? Why not learn a new exercise or sport or thing that just switches it up? It is springtime now, and it's maybe time for a little change. It's maybe time for a speedy gain for a little bit. And you can pursue it for as long as it serves you, and you don't need to hold on to it as the most sincere and central part of your identity. You can hold on to those changes like lightly held beliefs, like things that benefit you and serve you for right now and may change in the future. Life is all about living. It's all about doing the things that make you feel good and make you a better person. You don't need to be locked into just one thing. So this is what I have to say about the law of speedy gains and the law of diminishing returns. They are two sides of the same coin. And as long as you know that this exists and it's a general rule in just about everything that you do in life, you now have a tool that you can use to change your life and guide it. Thank you so much to listening to this very short podcast from Pokey Bear LLC in Denver, Colorado. Thank you so much. This was Scott Carney Investigates.